Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The United States has been on a long road toward increased standardization in our public schools. Over the past couple of decades, No Child Left Behind, Race to the Top, and the most recent Common Core initiative have come to define school reform by using computer-based standardized tests as benchmarks for evaluating teachers and students' performance. There are close to 50 million students and 3 million teachers in public schools. But most of the debates about education reform, testing, and the future of education are dominated by politicians and people working for corporate foundations. Today's guest, Christina Rizga, wanted to find out how these issues are playing out on the ground and what teachers and students think about the policies that experts and policymakers are implementing. So she decided to go back to high school. From 2010 to 2014, Christina immersed herself in San Francisco's Mission High School. It's one of the most diverse schools in the country. Mission High is technically a low-performing school, even though it has very high graduation and college enrollment rates. Christina spent hundreds of hours attending classes, hanging out with students, and interviewing teachers and the school's principal. She writes about her experience in the book Mission High, One School, How Experts Tried to Fail It, and the students and teachers who made it triumph. Christina's been writing about schools and youth issues for a decade, most recently as an education reporter for Mother Jones. And Christina will be speaking about her book next Tuesday, August 11th at 7:30 at the Booksmith in San Francisco. And Christina joins me in studio. Hi, thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Rose. Thank you so much for having us.
It's great to have you, and congratulations on your book.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Amy Ritchell. She's been teaching social and ethnic studies at Mission High for 10 years. Amy is co-chair of the Social Studies Department and also coaches teachers. And Amy also joins me in studio. Hi, Amy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for coming in. So this is a really interesting read because you give a voice to teachers and students, which you point out is pretty rare. Let's talk about how you first got on this journey, because 4 years is a long time to spend in a school. So you were asking these two questions when you were a reporter at Mother Jones. Why is it so difficult for the world's wealthiest country to build good schools? And then what motivates students to learn and persevere through life's toughest challenges?
Yeah, I remember sitting in the Mother Jones office with my editor at the time, Monica Bauerlein, and we were talking about these questions. And I think she knew that I had edited a youth-oriented magazine before, and I really loved spending time with teenagers. And she knew that I was, really enjoyed spending time with young people. And she also, she reported on the schools before, and she said that it's just so clear that, any story we open, we rarely hear from actual teachers and students when it comes to education reform. And I think it's really important to go to these schools and find out why is it so difficult to change and improve them and what's actually going on there. And, we decided that we would try to find a so-called failing school and just go there and find out why what do students and teachers actually think about all these different reforms and why is it so difficult for these things to change on the ground.
And you write that you wondered why there were very few accounts of how these national issues were playing out in the classroom. And you write, it turns out that there's a reason. It's easier for a journalist to embed with the army than go behind the scenes at a public school.
That's true. That's definitely a part of it. And in fact, I started to look for a school in September, and I reached out to a couple of high schools, and I didn't get very far. And I think that, part of it is, I think it was September and school was just starting out and teachers were and principals were overwhelmed. But a big part of it is also this was 2010, Waiting for Superman documentary just came out, which painted teacher unions as the villains behind all the problems in our schools. And I think teachers were just really wary of journalists. And they knew that most good stories that we found in the media were about charter schools. And whenever there was a story about a public school, journalists really kind of focus a lot of times on the negative side of the story. And so they were really wary of it. They didn't want their students to be stereotyped. They didn't want another negative story about public schools and journalists coming in with a lot of assumptions. So there was definitely a lot of that as well. And, and I think to some extent I lucked out because principal got hurt. was to be, you know, he was a longtime subscriber to Mother Jones. He really enjoyed the magazine. And also, you know, we just sat down and I think I took a different stance by the time I got to Mission High School. And I just honestly explained to him why I wanted to come to school and do these stories. I said, look, you know, I think it is really unfair that all of the most negative stories that we see are coming from public schools. So let me, you know, but if you want me to add more nuance to this story, I need to be able to be at the school and I need to be able to speak to students and teachers directly, not just administrators.
And Amy, you teach social and ethnic studies at Mission High, and you designed, well, a small group of teachers. You were at the forefront of a group of teachers that were designing ethnic studies curriculum, and you lobbied the district to fund it and offer it in every high school, which just got approved last year. And we'll talk about that later in the show. So you've done a lot of media talking about ethnic studies and why that's so important. But what are your thoughts about what Christina said, just about the fact that a select small group of people really dominate the conversation about what is now commonly referred to as education reform?
I think that when Christina was first starting to investigate into Mission High School, like you were saying, there's a lot of public media surrounding school reform and who actually has control over that. I think for me as a teacher and somebody who considers themselves to be politically active within the realm of education, it's so frustrating, and it's so important for us as educators to understand that we are professionals. I think the biggest thing that we should push for is autonomy. And it's one thing that I'm incredibly thankful for that I've been able to have at Mission High School is autonomy. In other words, respect from other professionals, respect from my principal, to actually do what I know is best for the school, my students, curriculum development. And so I think one thing that is incredibly important for teachers to know is that we are professionals, and that to see ourselves as academics and to actually move forward as such, and to be able to understand that while we are a body of professionals that gets top-down standards and control, that we also have the power to do that at our own sites. So that one thing that has been good for me to be at Mission High School as a developing teacher is to know that things that are really important are not the standardized tests to understand that we're going to be a good school. It's mentorship. It's curriculum development. It's collaboration. It's communication. It's all these things that we know is actually going to be better for our own professional development and to craft our own skills, and then also to figure out what's best for our own students on our own site, because not all sites are the same.
Right. And you feel like you have the independence to do all of that.
Correct.
And you learned a lot about teachers, Christina, because you write that the teachers never complain to you about being overworked, but the toll is obvious to anyone who spends a significant of time with them in and out of school. You write, every teacher I met frequently worked more hours than anyone I have met in the white-collar world. Journalism, technology, law, corporate, and nonprofit. You write about one teacher who wakes up at 5 a.m., goes to school by 6:30, leaves school at 4:30 for a dance class, then works almost every evening and every Sunday. Mm-hmm. You said almost every teacher you interacted with works on the weekends because they don't have time to put the lesson plans together during the week.
Yes, that was shocking to me, and that's, I think, true. You know, I've reported on other schools in other states and other cities, and it's especially true in our high-poverty, high-need schools, and it was extremely difficult for me to watch, and something that I really didn't realize. And, you know, I have to say that, and it was surprising to me that I watched this happen, and no one ever complained to me about the low pay or the long hours. But one thing that came up constantly, and that's something that Amy's referring to, is just this, you know, a lot of teachers just feel demoralized that they don't have time to do the kind of work that they know improve achievement and improve the quality of education. There's just chronic shortages of time to collaborate with each other, to learn from each other. Not, you know, Mission is better in this respect than most schools, and that's why it's successful. But that is a huge struggle in many schools, because when you have, you know, limited time and there's a student in your door who needs help with tutoring or needs help to write a college application or needs help write a resume or help him get a job, most teachers often prioritize that. And then the time that they had set up, you know, to collaborate and look at student work, it becomes harder to schedule that. But it's also extremely important to improve your craft and improve the quality of education. So that lack of time is a common theme that I've seen at Mission High School and other places. And then, of course, nationally, studies tell us that teachers in the United States have heavier teaching loads than teachers in almost any other industrialized country. And also, they spend much more time, much more of that time administering standardized tests. Studies say that on an average year, students take 10 to 20 standardized tests, and that, of course, doesn't include prep time for these tests. So that is the issue of time and the issue of testing are connected.
What would you add to that, Amy, just hearing Christina talk about teachers' experiences? How long have you been at Mission High?
This is coming on my 10th year.
And so what changes have you really seen over the years as we hear this debate about education reform? And when you do hear from teachers, you do definitely hear about the challenges and what you're facing.
I think in terms of the changes throughout the years that I've been at Mission High School, I think that I don't know necessarily about the debate, because I don't think that the debate has necessarily changed per se. There's still a lot of pressure on individual schools to comply to whatever the state or federal government stipulations are put on them. One thing that has been frustrating, however, is that as a technically a failing school, if we are given financial assistance by the federal government to improve our test scores, we get money, like what we received actually at Mission High School, to instill programs that we knew were best for our students, instill professional development, like the anti-racist teaching initiative that we put forward to give extra hours to teachers to disaggregate grades and to work specifically to improve the academics of our African American and Latino students, but also to kind of add different programs that we knew were going to be best for our students, like after school programs, summer programs. That money, once you throw that money into a technically failing school and expect for that money to be sufficient to actually be sustainable and to improve the overall state of the school itself, once that money's taken away, so are the programs. And so, again, next year we're going to be faced with this reality of money's not enough, right? So you have to, rather than just throwing money at programs, you have to, again, it goes back to my argument about autonomy. You have to be able to trust the teachers enough to know what is best for their students and to develop strategies that are going to be sustainable and to develop programs that will be able to be long lasting after this money is thrown at us. So I think that that's in terms of the way that reform is changing. Money's not enough. The standardized testing is not enough, right? To give teachers the respect to understand what's best for their own school, I think is something that needs to be looked at in more depth.
And so Mission High, again, is one of the oldest and most diverse public schools in the country. It's got 950 students holding passports from more than 40 countries. Latino, African American, and Asian American students constitute the majority of the school's population. 75% of the students are poor. 38% are English learners. We'll talk about Maria in a minute, who started as a freshman knowing absolutely no English. This is an amazing story. So according to test scores, Mission High is a, quote, low-performing/failed school. But at the same time, it has some of the highest graduation and college enrollment rates. So how is that possible?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question, and I definitely had the same these same issues were coming up as I was spending time in school. And I think some of it is, you know, multiple choice questions reveal a very narrow slice of knowledge. And, of course, students who are English learners or have had less exposure to certain skills or knowledge are not going to do as well on that. I mean, decades and decades of testing just tell us that they reveal differences in income and education level of parents, and not much more than that. So that's why I think the story of Mission High School is very important, because if you look at other data, right, if you at Mission High School, they don't just look at data to evaluate their students or how the school and the teachers are doing. They look at a variety of measures. They look at grades, and there are studies that tell us that grades reveal a broader range of intellectual and social and emotional skills, and can detect some of the more important higher order skills that multiple choice questions can't reveal. So teachers look at grades a lot. They disaggregate them. Teachers look at attendance. Teachers walk through classes and evaluate student work. They look at whether students are engaged with that work. They see how their skills and their knowledge and their confidence advance over the course of a year as they produce different drafts and different pieces of work. And they interview students and they interview teachers. So they use a variety of quantitative and qualitative data to see how schools are doing. And it gives us a much more accurate picture, not only for what's going on there in terms of learning, but also what needs to happen for the school to progress.
Right. So in some cases, the students were doing amazing jobs writing essays and giving public presentations in front of the classroom, mm-hmm. and they would get an A in class, but then do horribly on the test.
Right.
So how does the state deal with that? If a school is technically failing, but the overwhelming majority of the students are going to college and going to school, how does the state look at that?
I think it's, until recently, they still considered it a failing school, and there were huge consequences. And I think finally things are slowly changing, and California is definitely taking a lead on that in the nation. California currently is redesigning its accountability system to include broader measures to look at these both qualitative and quantitative measures. And of course, the Congress is also trying to rewrite the No Child Left Behind to allow states to design these accountability systems so that we can get a more accurate picture.
So in 2010, 84% of Mission High's graduating class was accepted to college.
Mm-hmm.
That's incredibly high, right?
Yeah.
And in a student survey, 89% said they liked Mission and would recommend it to others. By 2013, the graduation rate for African-American students was 20% higher at Mission, and college enrollment for black students was 14% higher than the district average. And yet it was still labeled a low-performing school.
Mm-hmm.
Amy, as a teacher at Mission High, what are your thoughts on that? How does that make you feel, that it's a failing school and yet so many kids go on to college?
I think that in a lot of ways, again, when you're in the day-to-day, I don't think about the failing terminology. I think in my broader context of understanding school reform and political aspects around public education, all I know is that I go into school every day and I'm learning from teachers who, like Christina said, have this broad range of success with students in different areas. So for example, I know that despite the fact that our school could be considered failing school, and I could go into work every day and say that this is how we are labeled and this is how my students are labeled, this is how I'm labeled, that's not going to make me be a better teacher. And so I go in and I try to figure out what's best for my students. When it doesn't work, I try again. And I go to my mentors in the school that have been there for years for me, and that have helped me, that have supported me. And we work together to raise the success of our students, you know. And San Francisco State has reported that we are a school that sends students to them with higher levels of critical thinking compared to some other high schools in the district. And that makes me feel good. As a history department co-chair, I know that the work that we do in our department around writing, particularly, is being successful as a critical thinker for a student. And I think that that is much more important to me, that my students can leave loving education, that they are excited about writing a research paper, that they're excited about making change in this world. Particularly my African American and Latino students, if you quoted those numbers, because those are the students that all of our students, of course, but those are the students that we're particularly focused on. And how do we work with those students and learn from them, learn from each other on how to really engage them, and not in any superficial way. But I want my students to leave Mission High School, prepared to love learning. And if that's at college, then that's at college. But if it's not, then I want them to still have some kind of love of education. And I think that preparing them for a standardized test, I could probably do that. You know, I could teach myself how to prepare them for a number of standardized tests, but that doesn't mean that they're loving what they're doing.
That is Amy Ritchell. She's been teaching social and ethnic studies at Mission High for 10 years. She's been at the forefront of a group of teachers in San Francisco who collectively designed ethnic studies curriculum and lobbied the district to fund it and offer it in every high school. It just got approved last year. We're also joined by Christina Rizga. She is out with a new book, Mission High, One School, How Experts Tried to Fail It and the Students and Teachers Who Made It Triumph. Christina spent 4 years at Mission High talking with teachers and students about things like testing, about what gets them excited about learning. And she writes about this in her new book. She'll be speaking on Tuesday, August 11th at 7:30 at the Booksmith in San Francisco. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. So we do a lot of shows about education, and we bring on a lot of teachers and students whenever we can.
Yes, we do.
And so what are your thoughts on what's changing with the education debate? Before the show, we were just saying that we don't hear much in the media today about, quote, failed teachers or bad teachers. That kind of died down in the last year. So what are your thoughts about the debate we are hearing today about reform, what it takes to improve education? What changes have you seen if you're involved in a school, if you have a child at school? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. And then what are your thoughts about how opinions on testing have really shifted in the past couple of years as the testing has been widely implemented, and now we're hearing about testing and its effects from teachers and students directly? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. We've got about a minute before break. So currently in California, what is the status of tests?
We've suspended using them for 2 years while the state is implementing the new Common Core standards and the tests, which I think is a really wise idea, which many other states didn't do, because of course Common Core standards are very different from what we had before, and teachers need time to redesign curriculum and make adjustments. And they're also, the funding wasn't there to make it happen. So it was a wise decision, I think, was made to not use them for a couple of years as we work through all the transitional glitches.
And so for 2 years, it's been suspended.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then what happens once Common Core is implemented?
It's hard to say. I think that the state of California is redesigning their accountability system right now. It'll probably take 2 years to really flesh it out and figure out, you know, what that looks like. Meanwhile, we're also waiting to see what happens at the federal level.
Today we're talking with Christina Rizga about her new book, Mission High, One School, How Experts Tried to Fail It and the Students and Teachers Who Made It Triumph. We're also joined by Amy Ritchell. She's been teaching social and ethnic studies at Mission High for 10 years. And we're talking today about school performance. How do you determine how well a school is doing if the students aren't doing well on tests, but most of them are going to college? This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To take part in today's conversation, call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. And if you'd rather write rather than call, you may email us to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about the public health implications of insufficient sleep. Sleep deprivation is linked to hypertension, diabetes, cancer, and most recently, Alzheimer's. So we're going to talk about the health effects of long-term sleep loss and what role race and economics play. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about education and also really looking at how the debate about education has really evolved over the years as teachers and students and so many people who do get on radio shows and televisions, for example, talk about the fact that it's just not black and white. Every school is very different. You've got a wide range of students. They all deal with different issues and problems. And so the debate as a result has really evolved. And we're talking about where we are today in California, as you just heard, testing has been put on hold, and we'll see what happens with Common Core. Christina Rizga wanted to ask questions about education, why students and teachers were missing from the debate. So she spent 4 years at Mission High in San Francisco, sitting in the classroom, basically being a student for 4 years. She writes about her experience in her new book, Mission High, and she'll be speaking about it on Tuesday, August 11th, 7:30 at the Booksmith in San Francisco. Christina's been writing about schools and youth issues for a decade, most recently as an education reporter with Mother Jones. Amy Ritchell has been teaching social and ethnic studies at Mission High for 10 years. She's been at the forefront of a small group of teachers who collectively designed ethnic studies curriculum and successfully lobbied the district to fund it and offer it in every high school. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you have a child in school and you have any stories to share about testing, about creative learning, do you feel like you have a voice in the process? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Elizabeth in San Francisco. Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's nice to talk with you. And hi, Ms. Rachel. Sophie says hi to you.
Hi.
My daughter just graduated from Mission.
Yeah, for 2 years.
Spring. And I just wanted to express my amazement at how wonderful every teacher and administrator we encountered there was. The students have, every student that I had contact with consistently talked about how much they love their school, and that is something I think you rarely hear from teenagers. And I also wanted to say that my children, my two kids, both attended what were considered low-performing schools in San Francisco throughout elementary, middle, and high school, and they both had quite amazing experiences. I can't have asked for a better experience for either of them. I think that the diversity that they experienced in those schools was an integral part of their educational experience, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. And I also just wanted to add, my daughter will be attending a prestigious Eastern college in the fall. So that experience at Mission High School contributed to the ability for her to go on and reach her potential in life.
Congratulations.
Yeah, wish her the best. I'm so happy for her.
Well, yeah, we're very excited.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Elizabeth, are you still on the line? Can I ask you, as a mom, how did you feel knowing that Mission High is technically labeled a failed school or a low-performing school?
So my children were enrolled. My son started kindergarten more than 15 years ago at a low-performing school. Hmm. And at first, it's a little daunting because just the what you hear, you know, in the playground is that you should try not to enroll your children in one of those schools if you can possibly help it. But when I went to see the school that my son was enrolled in, I realized this is a perfectly fine kindergarten. The kids look happy, the teachers are engaging, and I realized that the experience of the children in the school has a lot to do not just with the school, but with everything else that's happening in their life. And I knew that my children were going to do fine in a place like that. And it proved to be true. I think they actually did better at a diverse school than they would have at a place where everybody kind of looked like them.
Hmm. Well, thank you so much for calling in and sharing that story. And your daughter's about to enter a new journey. That's really exciting. Since you brought up diversity, Christina, in your book, you write about ethnic studies, and you write that the students and teachers of Mission High helped pass a resolution that will allow every high school student in the city to enroll in an ethnic studies class by 25th this year and next mm-hmm. year. Now, this I did not know about. Really interesting. A 2001 report found that of the 96 Americans who were named for study in the course descriptions in California, this is in the state of California, 77% white, 18% African American, only 4% Native American in California, and just 1% Latino, no Asian Americans at all. So ethnic studies classes have a huge gap to fill.
Absolutely. I was shocked to see that report, and I think that that's still the case in many schools across the country. And of course, you know, I saw that's definitely not that definitely wasn't the case in Mission, you know, even before ethnic studies. And I think watching it unfold made me realize how important it is to create curriculum not around standards and standardized tests, but around and this is something that the veteran teacher Perrette McCamey really taught me, is to create them around the students, individual students, and their interests, their initiative, their backgrounds. That is at the center, right? It doesn't mean that they don't create curriculum to include standards and pass some of those tests. That's definitely a big part of it. But the driving force is not our professional development is to adopt Common Core. Our professional development is how can we engage every single student and how can we help them succeed? And that means that they learn about the world and they learn about other cultures, but that there's also some reflection of their home and their past, and they can see where they come from and kind of figure out their place in the world and also be proud of their heritage.
And 90% of students in the district, San Francisco, are of color. 90%.
87 this year.
87, okay.
Since last year. Yes, 87, exactly.
Mm-hmm. And Amy, in December of 2014, there was a hearing on ethnic studies, and Christina writes about it in the book. And one of the students, Alejandra, was testifying. You were sitting behind her. And she said, when I went into history class, I could find nothing about myself. I could find nothing about my culture. But thanks to ethnic studies, I found the Filipinos, I found the Mexicans, and every other culture that was blacked out by the history books. So she said, my question's why? Why did we do wrong? What did we do wrong not to deserve to be put in these pages? Why are we set aside under the Anglo point of view? And I love the dialogue that Christina writes about in the book when she's sitting in the classroom, how all the students are actually learning from each other. And in some cases, I think it was there was a group of black girls in the bathroom doing their hair, mm-hmm. and then two Asian girls walked in mm-hmm. and quickly left because they thought they'd be bullied.
Right.
And the black girl said, no, we're nice. We want them to come in.
Right.
But there are these stereotypes that we're trying to overcome.
Mm-hmm. I'm so glad you brought this up, because this is a key part of, I think, what you learn in a diverse school. This is, and Jesmyn felt comfortable enough to bring it up in a classroom because teachers have set up a very safe environment to discuss issues, and there's plenty of time allocated in every class to discuss what students want to discuss. And Jesmyn brought it up, and the teacher, Mr. Roth, facilitated a really important conversation around stereotypes. And, he didn't just talk to students. Because he reads the work of his students every day, he remembered that there was a student who recently moved from China, and how, you know, she heard all these stereotypes about African-American students, but then she went to a predominantly black school, and what an amazing experience she had. And so he said, Rebecca, remember you were telling me about your experience in St. Louis? Could you tell Jesmyn about that? And so he brought her out because, you know, again, she feels comfortable telling him these things in her essays, and he reads her essays very carefully. And then he knew that another student, George, who I profile in the book, also heard all sorts of stereotypes, but he had a very different experience. So he asked if George would be comfortable to share his experiences about being at Mission, and how also to point out that his parents never say things like that. So it's not like every parent says something like that. It's just, you know, we all deal with social stereotypes. So it's just this beautiful moment where students learned about each other and were able to discuss it in a safe environment. And now they're equipped, you know, from this sort of daily exercise and this experience, they're equipped to deal with these conversations as they step out into the world compared to other students who go to segregated and isolated schools, right? In every workplace where I worked, I felt like people have a hard time moving through complicated sort of cultural discussions, right? People, as author Jeff Chang says, you know, we know how not what not to talk about, but we don't know how to talk about race. And I feel like unless you go to a diverse school like Mission, you never pick up those skills to do that.
And Amy, I'm assuming that these conversations happen regularly in your ethnic studies classes.
I think that I've been teaching ethnic studies since 2009. Mission High School was a school that taught ethnic studies even before the pilot came out, and was unanimously decided upon by the school board in 2010. So I've been teaching and I've been experimenting and I've been failing and succeeding and all these different things. You know, and my classroom has had to change dependent on who's sitting in front of me, right? Just like Christina had said, whoever's in my class, like I'm teaching them, you know, and I'm teaching them as a community of learners. And Sophie's class, for example, you know, I remember that ninth grade year very vividly, you know, and one of the things that I loved, one of the assignments that I love is an autoethnography. And then an oral history that I have the students do about one of their family members' understanding of race, ethnicity, nationality, or culture, right? And I get to learn so much about my students, you know? And I think that one of the things that is definitely a negative effect and of being labeled this failing school is that you have this misconception about the students that actually go there, mm-hmm. right? And so when you hear failing or you hear a bad school, it's usually tied to race. And so it's this assumption that the kids that go there are bad, right? And so you have exactly all these different stories, you know, like that have to be overcome. The systematic racism has to be overcome before these perceptions are even changed.
And also, some of these horrible stereotypes are reinforced through teachers, because Maria was telling you, Christina, mm-hmm, that she's been told, you know, you're from El Salvador. You're not going to college.
Right.
You need to just drop out and have babies, basically.
Right.
I mean, this is for a young student who's coming to the United States after her aunt was killed in El Salvador. She knows no English, mm-hmm, and she can't even ask where's mm-hmm the bathroom in English in ninth grade.
Right, right.
I mean, imagine how difficult that is.
That's a great point, and it's another, you know, negative impact of decades and decades of decades of putting failing labels on students of color. I think that teachers, white teachers, you know, if you're growing up in a suburban community and all of a sudden you're teaching a classroom that's, predominantly students of color, I think you bring those biases, mostly unconscious, with you. And I think that Mission High School has developed an incredible model that is very teacher-friendly, that is based on trust and respect, but that helps teachers examine, kind of reflect on their own biases that they bring into culture, which none of us are immune to, and work through them in a respectful environment. And I have a chapter on that at the very end, where a new teacher, Ali White, talks about how helpful it was for her to work with a veteran African-American teacher. You know, Ali White is white, and she's teaching predominantly students of color. And when things are happening in the news related to race and Black Lives Matter, how can students want to talk about it, right? They want to talk about it, and it's a very difficult thing to talk about. She spent a lot of time talking with me how important it is to work with veteran teachers of color and skilled professional teachers to learn how to navigate these conversations and be an effective teacher with all students.
Christina Rizga is the author of Mission High, One School, How Experts Tried to Fail It and the Students and Teachers Who Made It Triumph. For 4 years, Christina was sort of like a student at Mission High. She interviewed students. She spent time with them outside of school. She also interviewed teachers and the principal of Mission High. Mission High is one of the most diverse public schools in the country. The school has 950 students holding passports from more than 40 countries. 75% of the students are poor. 38% are English learners. It's technically considered a failed school, but it has very high graduation and college enrollment rates. We're also joined by Amy Richel. She's been teaching social and ethnic studies at Mission High for 10 years. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about school performance. How do you really determine how well a school is doing if tests are low but graduation rates are high? And also, what happens when teachers and students say no to testing and yes to creative learning? And we have another ethnic studies teacher on the line. Let's go to Irv in San Francisco. Hi, Irv. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. I'm a retired teacher, and I started an ethnic studies class at Woodrow Wilson back in the 60s. I was real fortunate. I had kids from all over the world, basically Samoans, Latinos, and blacks there.
Irv, can you turn down your radio?
That's my... hold on just...
So this is Irv. He taught ethnic studies at Woodrow Wilson, and he's sharing his experience, and hopefully he's going to be back from turning his radio.
Yeah, here I am.
Okay, there you go. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll get you in a second. Hold it. Okay.
All right.
There?
Yes, go ahead, Irv.
Okay. I taught a class basically called FACES, which had kids from all the ethnic groups in the school. And we did various things, but basically, one of the big things that we did was share experiences. I had the Samoan kids tell stories about their growing up, and the black kids, and all the people telling stories to one another, and the class was very successful. However, the administration sort of fought me at every turn, and the kids had various nicknames for me, and I just had a wonderful time as a teacher up until 2002 when I retired. But I got along well with kids and not necessarily with the administrators of many schools.
A common theme I hear. Thank you for sharing that. You were laying the groundwork in the 60s. That's so nice to hear.
Yeah, I was rewarded recently where a former student of mine took a collection of short stories and put it into a book form. He wanted to do a small press publishing, and he took this collection of short stories about my interrelation with teachers, with kids, and put it into a collection. I'm not going to mention it because I don't want to be, mm-hmm. push the book, but it's an interesting book.
You can push it.
I can
That's
push
okay.
it. Irv. Yeah, I
what's
love
it. It. What's it called, Irv?
I'm sorry?
What's the book called?
It Couldn't Have Been the Pay.
Hilarious.
Wow, that is perfect. Well, thank you so much, Irv. Thanks for calling, and thank you for dedicating your life to teaching kids. We kind of have a related question. Let's go next, speaking of pay, let's go next to Tom in San Francisco. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you. I'm kind of curious about how did the community place their teachers in living conditions? I mean, was there something that the teachers could actually live in the community, or how far did they have to travel to get to school and find a place to live?
So I think it varies. I am incredibly lucky enough to have found an apartment 11 years ago that's in Hayes Valley. And so I walk to school every day, unless it's raining, and then I take the bus sometimes. But a lot of teachers that I know have had to move to the East Bay because it's cheaper for them to either buy a home or to even find a rental. But it also has really changed my outlook on why I'm an educator, what it means to be an educator. And so if at some point in time I do have to move, I would definitely consider changing schools. I think that it's really important, and this is not necessarily a critique on any teachers whatsoever, but for me personally, it's incredibly important to work near the community that I serve. It's really important to me, and I think it makes me a more effective teacher that I live right down the street from a bunch of my students, mm-hmm. or that people, you know, the students are like, Miss Rachel, I saw you on the 22. What were you doing? You know, it's like that's really, really important to me. And that means a lot to my practice. And it also means a lot to my own philosophy of education and community. And I don't think that that's anybody's fault if they have to move from the city. I mean, it's obviously a larger systematic issue at hand. But that's my own experience. But a lot of teachers at Mission that I know of do not live as mm-hmm. close as I do.
And I was talking to Principal Gutherz about it actually just last week. He told me this is his biggest issue that he faces. He still has 3 unfilled positions, and it is because most of folks who left told him, I love Mission, but I can't afford to live here anymore. And some that I know have, since I've been at the school, moved to the East Bay and are now commuting, you know, from Mountain View, from Oakland, and more, in my experience, more teachers are commuting than living in San Francisco, and it's a huge problem.
Hmm. Are they talking about solutions to this? I mean, is there dialogue between the city and educators?
I think Superintendent Carranza is raising this issue very often. I definitely hear him discussing it on radio. And there's some pilots that I think different cities are trying, you know, stipends to help cover the rent. I think we're just now starting to realize what a huge issue this is. And it's definitely being discussed. Not sure if that there are any... I haven't seen any promising solutions.
Yeah, that's something that we should look into. Well, thank you again for calling in, Tom. Let's go next to Deb in San Francisco. Hi, Deb. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you. Rose, I really admire your show, and I love the topics that you cover.
Thank you.
First, I just wanted to mention that in addition to the superlative teaching and obviously the examples that you have of the people that are on the show today are examples of that, there is a nonprofit that operates as a mentoring program out of Mission High to assist the students of different ethnic backgrounds who have interest in going to college navigate the college application process, and they mentor them for multiple years to get them prepared to go through the process and to successfully be able to apply for college, because a lot of the students do not have parents who have been to college before. They don't actually have the experience of what that process of application is about. And so this nonprofit that's established in the school and that gets funding from a variety of sources does mentor in that environment students who will eventually get into colleges in California mm-hmm. and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Which nonprofit are you referring to?
I wish I could remember the name.
There's actually several. ASAP? Is it ASAP or... There's actually several. There's
College Connect.
College Track is a great program.
Yeah. I think it's called College Connect, but I'm not.
Yeah.
You can't quote me on it.
Mm-hmm.
I know that it's funded by this, or partially funded mm-hmm. by this organization called Society for Community Works, which is connected to the university.
Yeah.
Step to College, maybe.
Yeah, no, so the Bay Area is actually really lucky. We do have a lot of nonprofits. You know, every student, I mean, honestly, so many students I've talked to over the years are engaged with several, 2-3 nonprofits mm-hmm. who are all helping them gain the skills and, you know, get keep track of their applications. And also, there's a teacher at Mission High School, Amadeus Velez, who's sort of become, you know, legendary for, you know, making sure that every student at Mission, as soon as they're a freshman, they're thinking about college, because this is sort of what we have in a lot of under-resourced schools that I've reported on in other cities, is students don't find out about, you know, they start thinking about college applications in the very last year. And of course, that often means it's too late to get scholarships and grants. So, or they didn't know what sequences of classes they had to take. So this is another innovation, sort of Mission High School, right? They'll sit down their students at some point in freshman year and make a plan to go to college.
They're definitely doing something right because they have such huge college acceptance rates. You focus on specifically on Mission High, but what about other schools in San Francisco? Are they similar to this? And what role does the school district play in allowing and supporting, taking this kind of path and really embracing creative learning? Mm-hmm. Amy?
I think we were actually talking about this the other day. I think that there are a couple of schools that actually within the district kind of really focus on like these different alternative ways to educate students. But I think that one of the reasons that they have been almost allowed to is because they're dealing with students that nobody else really wants to deal with. And I say that in that, you know, like you're not going to get a lot of these alternative forms of education at schools where the test scores are incredibly high because nobody really wants to rock the boat. And so Downtown High School, for example, is an incredible example of experiential learning. It's an alternative high school where actually a continuation high school where these are the kids that, have the school system has failed them completely. And they get to Downtown High School and they're met with incredible love and compassion by a really impressive force of education force. At the moment, unfortunately, they've been hit with a tragedy by a teacher, Ed Kavanaugh, who led this incredible program that got kids out and like built boats, right? And they go on backpacking trips. Ed Kavanaugh has been missing for over 2 weeks now, and his former students, kids that hated school, right, are in the forefront of the relief effort to find him and who found love through experiential learning.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time, but we will. Gosh, I hope that I hadn't heard about that. Is it getting a lot of media coverage?
It has.
Locally.
Okay. Yeah. Local. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for sharing that story. Amy Richel has been teaching social and ethnic studies at Mission High for 10 years, and Christina Rizga is author of the new book, Mission High, One School, How Experts Tried to Fail It and the Students and Teachers Who Made It Triumph. She's speaking on Tuesday, August 11th at 7:30 at the Booksmith in San Francisco. Amy and Christina, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having us, Rose. It's such an honor. I love your show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Public health implications of insufficient sleep. On the next Your Call, we'll talk about the health effects of long-term sleep loss and what role race and economics play. Sleep deprivation is linked to hypertension, diabetes, obesity, cancer, and most recently, Alzheimer's. Research also associates impaired sleep with disparate health outcomes between racial ethnic minorities. The CDC says insufficient sleep is a public health epidemic, but are we treating the problem as seriously as we should? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.